So this class, this workshop, publishing in the digital age, is that the exact words of it? As I'm sure you all know, publishing world is changing. The world of music has changed dramatically and will continue to change. And what we thought we would do today is talk about some key concepts. Bob Coughlin had asked for us to cover a few things, and then we thought we could throw it open for Q&A for a large amount of the time. And see if we can help equip you, help you understand kind of different things. So I'm Steve Cook, and I'll kind of moderate as much as is needed. I may be repeating your question for the recording. This is Brooke Shinen. I just met him 10 minutes ago.
It's Brock.
Brock. I'm sorry.
It's close.
I don't know why I said Brooke. I knew his name's Brock. Like I said, 10 minutes ago. And he is a kind of a surprise guest with us, but he'll be a wonderful addition. I know of Brock through Malcolm, and Malcolm and I were just talking a few minutes ago. He thinks we met in 1987. I know around that time we were singing one of his songs, We Declare Your Majesty.
Yeah.
And we did that often in our church in the late 80s there.
We did.
And so I could probably do a poor job of telling you the background of some of these gentlemen, so I'd like to get them to tell us a little bit about them. So Malcolm's originally from South Africa, if you're wondering about the accent. He's worked a lot in Christian publishing in the U.S. and the U.K. But fill in some of the details for us. What's kind of your story?
I was a worship leader in my 20s, church leader, church planter, and had a chance to be involved in my 20s in my country with a musical worship project that was innovative to some degree. It was multicultural, multilingual, project that dealt with the integrity of the kingdom of God and the injustice of my country in one foul swoop, and basically was a person who was involved in the worship world and political activism altogether. So I had a radical youth, and for various reasons have had the chance to travel the world, have lived in the U.S. for 20 years, and have consulted for just a huge chunk of my life in the Christian music industry. For now I'm like a well-meaning has-been. So I was someone who had a wonderful life in my 20s, and now I just help younger people and music industry. So I've served for 20 years almost as Malcolm in the Middle, for example, between Kingsway Music in England, which is the home of Matt Redman and Tim Hughes and all those people, and then EMI Christian Music in America, which is the home of a whole bunch of people of the Passion Movement, etc. And I've been the liaison between those two entities, and I'm just involved in various different initiatives from time to time that are very, very random. And so I'm just an elderly Forrest Gump in a funny kind of a way.
What are you currently involved with?
Currently, I still consult for EMI Christian Music, which is called Capital. So I'm involved. They're friends for many years, so I'm involved with that organization. Together with Capital, I'm involved with a project which is launching in September, which is a new online resource for worship called modernhymnal.tv. And that's going to basically I've been a good friend for many years with Stuart Townend, who many of you will know from being the lyricists in particular of songs like In Christ Alone and How Deep the Father's Love, and have been the custodian and the champ and the sort of like crusader for songs that have great lyrical content. And then several years ago, some other Brits did a project which was rewrites of old Charles Wesley hymn texts with new melodies. And when the guys played me the project, I said, we struggle to communicate to Stuart's songs because the world is the pop, praise and worship has become a pop culture, and there's not much interest always in stuff that is very substantive. But I said, the same churches that love How Deep the Father's Love will love this rewrite of Oh for a Thousand Tongues to Sing. Let's marry those two together. And through a long journey of trying to do it with my companies, I'm actually doing it with a few people outside of the companies, but in partnership with one of the companies that I've served, and we're basically creating a .tv where it will be a TV-based, like a Vimeo, like a YouTube-based site that will just be the aggregating place for all the new hymns and the strongest rewrites. So that's a project I'm involved with. I'm involved with many things. I'm involved with an initiative right now, particularly in partnership with these young guys in Tennessee called United Pursuit, and it's very much a world music project. So I'm involved with a bunch of different worship leaders trying to actually uncolonize the praise and worship culture, where right now the privileged countries of the world take their songs, and so every other country other than England and Australia and America, they sing all of our songs, and we're on a long-term mission to actually go treasure hunt the beautiful songs from Kazakhstan and Ecuador and Malawi and Tasmania and bring them to our culture. And that's going to take a long time, but that's a project I'm involved with. I'm an activist at heart. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. This is me being an activist. So, et cetera, et cetera. Just random, very random, well-meaning things. Some of them work, some of them are total flops.
Thank you. So Brock has law offices here in Orange County, Anaheim Hills,
yeah,
recently,
yeah,
and work with media, entertainment, intellectual property, probably a number of other things, I think, on your website. What kinds of things have you done in the area of like publishing or working to help groups publish?
Yeah, so background-wise, I grew up in a musical family. My grandparents had a traveling quartet, mm-hmm, traveled the world, and so I was on the road a lot with them. Grew up, my mom was a worship leader, my dad was a pastor, I've been a worship leader at different points, but more recently what I do is essentially entertainment law, what you might narrow down to entertainment law. There's a strong emphasis on intellectual property, so copyrights and trademarks and things like that, but I work with, since I've started my own practice about 10 years ago, I've always tried to devote more than half of it to helping churches, ministries, people in ministry, in those areas of entertainment, songwriting, publishing, and all that. So I do everything from negotiate deals with like EMI or Capital or Kingsway or whoever the different publishers or labels that are out there, to helping churches launch, you know, start and launch their own label or publishing company, and pretty much everything in between.
Okay, good. For those of you, myself, I work for Sovereign Grace Ministries. Primarily, I oversee the production of the music. So Bob is my direct boss, and so I would do all the hands-on producing and management of the producing. And so, yeah, we've got kind of some complimentary things going on here, huh? So one of the first things Bob asked us to talk about was publishing a song. It's not what it used to mean, which was having like a major label pick up your song and put it on a recording or put it in the songbook. Malcolm, let's start with you. What do you think publishing a song looks like today? What are the possibilities?
Should we ask one question before we do that?
Certainly.
Are all of you songwriters? Yes. And do all of you, does the word publishing mean something to almost everybody? Okay. So, I mean, essentially publishing predates the CD, and it's called publishing because what happened when the only way to communicate a song was photostat, or we didn't have photostat machines copying the music, the written music. So historically, there's been a very viable business in which a songwriter contracts with an organization where they partner, where the organization takes responsibility for all the organization of everything to do with that song and the communicating of that song and finds places for those songs to be used. The world has obviously changed in the music business in the last 30 years, so there's very few people who don't record their own songs, because so even if you're not a songwriter, you write with your friend who's a very good songwriter, and you split the money. So it's an industry that makes money, and historically there's been an industry which has gone and plugged the songs. Things are all in transit. Things are changing. Our world is changing. The internet is has changed everything. And some days I wake up and I think it's a very legit, wonderful business and a fair thing that happens in life, where because I've, for example, something I did 18 to 17 years ago was be involved in the arrangement between Kingsway Music and EMI, when no one had ever heard of, in America, had ever heard of Matt Redman or anybody from England. And those songs were not prevalent in America, but basically was a person who encouraged that these two entities purchased and did a business deal together so that those songs from England could be heard in America. And it's been very successful. It's grown financially by a multiple of like 40 times. So it's been a very blessed operation. But through that process of this publishing company actually taking on these songs and championing these songs, those songs have been sung and are ubiquitous in our faith. They're sung everywhere now. So there's been a real valid fruit from that operation. So I believe in it, and I think it has dignity. Sometimes I wonder how much dignity it has, because sometimes it's possible for people to do it all by themselves without those infrastructures, without another person in the mix, you know, speaking into your life. And I think there's dignity in both, and there's different situations that work for different people. I don't think I'm being very coherent, but I'm trying to make a couple introductory comments.
Sounds good. So Brock, how about on the question then of publishing a song, what do you see in some of the clients that you have? How are they trying to make that work?
I think one of the biggest changes we've seen in maybe the last decade is that there are so many tools now available to songwriters to get your songs out there. And there's a tension between the history of the industry being you use a publisher, a formal, legitimate publisher to get your songs out there. And I think nowadays, because of the availability of tools to get your songs heard, it's a constant tension that songwriters face where, well, why? If they do this and I could do that, why? And so one of the biggest things I see is counseling a lot of these songwriters through what are the pros and cons of you doing it yourself? What are the pros and cons of the publisher doing it? You know, where do you win? Where do they win? Where do you lose? Where do they lose? And so a lot of it has just changed the conversation, the nature of the conversation.
Good. Let's go on to the next thing Bob had mentioned, and that is something of an overview of the state of the union of publishing, let's say, in the worship arena or area. We'll limit it to that. Brock, you want to start first? You might have a better, bigger picture view than we would.
So, Malcolm knows me well. Part of the state of the union is a heart state of the union. And one of the biggest things I've seen is that it's almost like a gold rush, and that a lot of songwriters see songwriting in the church particularly as an opportunity to make money. And I'm not suggesting that making money is wrong. I'm suggesting that to get into songwriting or to write songs for that purpose, for me personally, I think is a bad idea. The state of the union on that part is that because there's so many tools, there's so many ways that songwriters can impact the church now, there's such a draw to do it for money. And I think that draw has never existed in history to the extent it exists now. So there's that. There's also sort of the technological, sort of state of the union where because people couldn't get a song out there in the past, we were limited, you know, to the amount of songs we would hear, the amount of songs that people would write. And so now, if you know that you can get your local church to sing a song, you're more likely to write. And so I think in like this wellspring of songwriting, some of it is for very good reason. Some of it is for not for good reason. But the state of the union is there's a gigantic mass of songs out there. There's more than a sufficient number of songwriters. So content-wise, there's just an explosion of content. Mm-hmm. Heart-wise, I think there's more tension than there's ever been because the temptation to write for a certain purpose versus another is greater than it's ever been. And I think the other thing, too, is I'll stop there.
Yeah, no, that's good. Malcolm,
if I can make a comment on the church and how it impacts this world. Because I know I live in this arena, and lots of people say all the Christian businesses are terrible and Nashville's terrible. There's a lot of really decent people actually in Nashville. Respectful people who have been, to me, very humble and very, very charmed and godly people. The people in Nashville, the people in the industry that exists, are only as successful when they follow the trends that are happening in the church and Christianity is changing. A quick comment. I'll make sense of my comment. God's intention, ultimately, if you read in Exodus chapter 19, was that his people were a collaborative community of priests, a priesthood, where everybody played a vital role. But they didn't want to be that. They wanted to be like the other nations. That tussle exists today. It doesn't have the financial opportunity. It has a financial opportunity that didn't exist in Exodus chapter 19. But there's been that constant tussle, usually summarized in the word idolatry, throughout history. When Jesus came, it was a wonderful sigh of relief from God once again to reintroduce this lovely concept of a priesthood. Now it was elevated to a royal priesthood, an interactive community where everybody could participate, and that's how worship is described in the New Testament. But very soon, it dissolved from that, and it became one person singing in a foreign language where most people couldn't participate. And so we have this whole journey through history. Prior to the Reformation, the Bohemian Brethren were the first people in the 1400s. In 1501, they released the first songbook ever, 89 songs, and they championed that people would be able to sing in their own language, and everybody could sing, not just one guy singing in Latin, and the leader, Jan Hus, was burned at the stake. And there's just a whole journey that we've had with people campaigning for the entire community to participate. But we've always wanted to be like the other cultures. And that has been exacerbated further in the last 40 years, because prior to David and Dale Garrett recording the first scripture and song record in 1969 in Auckland, New Zealand, the idea of a musical worship leader was not prevalent. It's now become the norm. The concept of a worship leader has a 44-year-old concept. The idea of a seamless worship set with songs strung together is a 44-year-old concept. It didn't exist really before 1969. And then the role of the worship leader is the most sought-after gift in Christianity that's not mentioned, alluded to, or hinted at the Bible even once. There's something to be considered in that, and I won't go into all those, rabbit trails. But essentially, we've gone from the worship leader becoming the key thing in Christianity to the worship band becoming the key thing in Christianity, to the visuals and the show and the lights and I remember the first church that put off the lights in worship was here in California, but 25 years ago, and now there's tens of thousands of churches where it's intelligent lights and all the stuff that's happened. And so the publishing industry has just followed that and supported a trend where we want to be like the other nations. So we become more of the audience than the vital collaborative community of priests that vibrantly participate in the worship encounter. And so the publishing industry it cannot be blamed, because there's something else that's happened in the church that desperately needs to be evaluated on a constant basis. So the state of the play of the publishing business is it's become the support to an entertainment culture where there's a countdown, 5 minutes, 4 minutes, 3 minutes, everything about when we go into our building is an entertainment idiom, metaphor that's been expressed. And so it's substantiated in the background by this industry, but this industry actually is an evaluation and possibly can play a vital role for songs to be communicated in a better way. I don't know if that was helpful. That was probably not the answer to the question, but I think it's important to consider, because I think we have to consider these concepts in the context of the landscape of what's happening in Christianity.
You know, what I wanted to add as well, and we'll probably touch on this more later, but in terms of the economics, there's a situation now that I think can be more of a temptation, in that the way things have shifted from how people used to make money in music, like for instance, in secular music, most big artists probably make money off their tours over their recording sales, like 20 or 30 to 1 ratio. I was looking at something recently, it was a Taylor Swift maybe from last year, and it was like she made you know, 30-some million, and like 1.5 million of it was from record sales, and the rest was mostly tour money. So we've had that shift where there's not a lot of money to be made by selling digital product or music product. But in the church, something opened up that the average secular artist doesn't have to them, and that's CCLI. And so CCLI becomes probably potentially the biggest money earner for a worship songwriter, much more so than CD sales or MP3 sales, and maybe even more than they could get in honorariums playing places. So it creates a temptation. In other words, people can think, hey, if I can just write some great worship songs and get in a church, you know, I can make some money. Whereas that temptation wouldn't have been there like 40, 45 years ago. People would have just been writing for their local church, and if it served their church, great. And if God, you know, elevated things, then, you know, that was great as well. So anyway, I know we'll talk about hard issues later, but the way the market's changed to me, that it has created different temptations for folks, for musicians as well.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah, sure.
So part of that has been that in Christianity today, unlike 10 years ago, songs are proliferated around personalities. So each of you in this room would consider yourself subliminally a something church. You prefer, you tend toward the songs that come from this source, and you follow what's on someone's CD. And that was not so prevalent 15 years ago. People were looking for songs because of that collaborative community, and now it's become artist-dominated. And that opens up wonderful doors for certain people to express their giftedness, and many of those people have a wonderful contribution to make, but it shuts down the opportunity for creativity, diversity, and just freshness in Christianity.
Sure. To follow along, sorry. CCLI met a particular need, and I, from my perspective, especially as an attorney, you know, when you look at how you value a piece of music, you know, and there's so many ways to monetize a piece of music, and we know, you know, from everything from iTunes to Spotify to radio to whatever, everything in between. In some senses, the worship leader was at a disadvantage because there were ways that the songs were being used that legitimately could be monetized that weren't. And so in the secular and the Christian world, you have performing rights organizations, ASCAP, CSAC, BMI. They collect performing rights revenue. So when you hear a song on the radio, things like that. There wasn't a counterpart in the church, and yet so many of the songs were being used in the church. And so CCLI definitely filled a need, it filled a void to make it viable for a songwriter to actually live off of the money that they generate from their songs. But there's a byproduct to that, which is this temptation and attention.
Yeah, that's good. So let's take a look at just talking about the current publishing environment. What would be, Brock, what would be important things you think, you know, these folks are here, they write songs, they're wondering about publishing. What avenues are available to them? What would you see as pros and cons to those?
To actually publish a song?
Yeah, whether it's themselves or with, a publisher, established publisher.
Yeah. I think one of the things is there's probably an idea now more than ever that the average person has access to a major, which in reality, the average songwriter probably doesn't. But because there's so many songwriters, there's so many songs out there, there's just, things like YouTube make you feel like everybody can be a star, everybody can be on TV. But YouTube is not TV. And so part of it is stepping back and understanding, do I even have access to a publisher? Are my songs good enough? And that's a fact that a lot of songwriters don't want to face. They write songs and their church, they may explode in their church. But outside of their church, people may not care. And I know that's a cold, hard reality, but it is a reality. And so part of what you have to consider as a songwriter, do you even have access to a publisher? And if you do, maybe you know somebody who knows somebody who could get your songs into Malcolm's hands. And, you know, that can help you out. But at the end of the day, publishers are deciding, looking at a song, they're looking at a couple of things, but I would say the most, the top tier issues are, does anyone care? You know, is your own church singing this song, or is it just you and your family? Are a lot of people singing this song? And on top of that, has it made money? you know, have you done anything with it? Now, granted, you may have written a song that did well, publisher didn't have access to it, but now they're interested in you because of that history. But as far as looking at a major publisher, that's kind of the questions you have to ask yourself. Do you have a good enough song, honestly? Do you have access to a publisher? And you could send out, you know, query letters all day long. You can try and get that stuff out there. Over the long haul, good stuff will tend to rise to the top. It'll start in your local church, it'll grow out of your local church, and publishers will hear about it. And that's not to say that a great song can't wind up outside the church, because sometimes a great song lives in its own church and that's it, and it sort of dies there. The other piece of that is, okay, what about independent publishers and what about self-publishing? I think at this phase in history, and based on what's out there for songwriters, you have to really evaluate, what are you trying to accomplish? Do you want to make money as a songwriter? Do you just want to get a song heard? I mean, I'm sure millions of motivations for what your reasons are. But if you figure those out, an independent, ultimately, as Malcolm pointed out, a publisher was in part designed to get your songs out there into the world. So most people have no ability to do that. Most people have a limited ability to get songs sung in their church, and maybe that's it. Some worshipers start to become well known outside of their local church, and that's how they can get the songs out there. So there's also this question of, I'd like to self-publish because I keep more money, I keep ownership. There's a lot of logical reasons to do your own publishing, except they're illogical for many people. To preserve ownership, it's like, would you rather own 100% of, you know, you've heard this before, but you know, whatever the context is, a pie, a penny, whatever. 100% of nothing or 10% of 1,000. The point is maintaining ownership, maintaining control, maintaining the ability to dictate how and where and when your song is used is only a small part of the equation.
A couple other things. Go ahead, ma'am. What did you have?
Let me just make this comment about the nuts and bolts of publishing business. I'll say something I think will help you reflect. Most of us know any songwriter that we're aware of through the lens of one song. I could mention any name, or you could think of all the people that you like, and you'll know that you connected with them because of one song made an impact on your life. Once that one song made an impact on your life, they can dish up the most silly song they like, and you're still open. And you actually listen to it with a gracious spirit, because somehow there's that song that just was cool and you want to like it. So if a publisher does his job, it really is to find one song that just blazes a trail for the rest of the songs that come in their catalog. That's a thought. So I just say, EMI, the company I've worked for, it owns, well, now it's just sold to Sony, but it's owned 1 million songs. All of us know that the people that work for that company collectively know a few thousand of those songs. It's just a big vault of stuff. It's impossible. But the companies grab a bunch of stuff because they're all looking for those one or two things that open doors. If you are going to approach a publisher or someone, if you feel destined that you have a role to play in Christianity as a songwriter, contributing to the liturgy of Sunday morning music, great wisdom before even finding who can help you promote the song is actually establishing the song that you have that is a door-opening, trailblazing song. The people, I have a little life in pop music and country music, the people that are successful in country music particular, the big names, they write 2 songs a day, 5 days a week, and write hundreds a year, probably get 1 number 1 hit, the big guys a year, and probably get 40 to 60 cuts. There are a lot of songs that are written. In Christianity, someone writes 10 songs and makes a new CD. I know, we've got a couple connections in music outside of Christianity that are influential people, and they work themselves to the core and write hundreds of songs sometimes to find those 10 songs. The famous story in music, Bette Midler, when she made her first record, not that I'm promoting Bette Midler or saying I've ever listened to her in my life.
Liar.
But she listened personally to 5,000 songs to make her first CD. That's the stats of impetus. So if we're going to come to a publisher, if we're going to go to a publisher, if we want to have an impact, we actually have to have the self-evaluative infrastructure to identify a door-opening song that can blaze a trail. And the best a publisher can do is help identify that and do that. They can't do much else. But if they do that, the dominoes fall rapidly and can open up all kinds of other doors. I think that hopefully that makes sense to each of you. So I have a friend who I've worked with for many years who's doing really well in pop music and country music. He first worked with a certain producer publishing company, and I encouraged him to do this deal because it was meant he got a song placed on a Rascal Flatts record. Well, he was very excited, but it wasn't a single, and it was a good selling record, but it wasn't a big, it didn't change his career. But then soon after that, Lady Antebellum said, "Would you come write with us?" And so he did, and then he got a number two hit, I think, with that song. But then he said to me, "Well, this person didn't do anything for this song." And I said, "There ain't no Lady Antebellum in your life. It isn't for the guy who put you on Rascal Flatts' record. Chill out." because the dominoes have fallen and all other things happen. So the nature of publishing business, in my crude sort of estimation, is the skill to identify a really, really significant song and do everything one can do to make a trail for that, and then hope a few more can squeeze through the door in time. Any expectations more than that are kind of delusional, because there's just not enough people doing it. There's just not a lot of opportunities, and there's just not a lot of people that record the songs.
A couple thoughts come to mind on what you just said. One is the importance that one song can make as a songwriter in your career. And what I would suggest from that is the importance of making every song you write as good as it can be. Now, once you've got to the point it's as good as it can be, then fine. But if you know there's things that could be stronger, don't do it yet in public. Don't release it. Make it as good as it can be. It may be the one song that opens some doors for you. The other thought was, one way in which the music publishing world has changed is there used to be, when there was more money to be had, more of a developmental budget within major labels. And from what I hear, that's largely non-existent now. And so they tend to look for things like the cream rising to the top and then cherry pick, because it's easier for them. It's a proven commodity. You know, this person's been around 5 years. They've written 50 songs, and they're growing, and they're the churches that are doing their songs. And so it's easier for them. It's less risk that way. It takes less money. Transitioning to, so if a songwriter is thinking, "I want to publish my own, there's no publisher that's interested in me, but I do want to take some steps to get my songs out, songs to be heard," there's sort of plans you can follow now, like for indie bands. You know, there's like Bobby Oswinski had a book out, Music 2.0. It kind of outlines things. I have in front of me Music in the Digital Age by Andrew Dubber, where he talks about important concepts if you're an indie artist and you want to grow your career. But it's a little bit different in worship music, you know, because of the context and because you're not out touring, you know, all the time. What would you suggest or recommend as possible ways to get your songs heard? The internet or live performances or whatever combination you think could be successful for an independent songwriter of worship songs.
That's all Rob first, because he's the expert.
Okay.
I think any of you, well, you're all songwriters, so you know there are tools out there, like everything from Bandcamp to Topspin to, the list is long. The inclination would be to just follow in the footsteps of the music industry and use every tool available, YouTube, everything, and just kind of throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And something you said, Steve, that it, and this is a respectful disagreement, yeah, and I'll explain what I mean, is that when you said, hold back your song until it's the best that it can be, and then get it out there, because that, I completely agree, when the objective is to get the best song out there. I think there's another school of thought that would be, if any of you guys read Seth Godin stuff, a big marketing guy, and he just, one of his things is just ship it, just get it out the door. And there's a part of me, there, even internally, there's a part of me professionally and as a creative type where I completely agree with you. And then the other side of me is like, but how do I get better if I, you know, Malcolm talked about guys writing 200 songs, you know, in a year versus a worship leader writing 10 songs and being like, I got those 10. If you can't write 100 in a year, then you're not an experienced songwriter. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way, and I'm not saying that to any of you. I'm saying in a general sense, part of what makes you better at anything is if you've read, I forget the guy's name, slips my mind, but, you know, 10,000 hours into something makes you an expert. Whether you agree with that or not is up to you. The point is, the more that you output, the more experienced you become at what you do. And so I look at, to get back to the question of being, how do we actually do that? Do you use YouTube? Do you create a channel? Do you use Bandcamp? Do you use Topspin? Do you use the tools that exist? Or do you write songs as often and as much as you can and sing those in environments where people are going to latch onto them, which is usually your local church, your Bible studies, your home groups, whatever you have an impact on, and to continuously do that. And does that mean you don't do a YouTube channel or throw up some videos? That's up to you. Do you have a blog? That's up to you. But your focus is, I mean, think about Apple. Think about real life, you know. Apple gives you, you know, MacBooks, they give you iPhones, they give you iPads, they give you everything. The product is great, but it will go through iterations. It'll go through changes. And I think with songwriting, part of what you go through is an iteration as a songwriter. You become better. And I really think the focus is between you, God, and outputting. And all those tools, use them if they make sense. Don't if they don't. But I know this is not the answer that most of you would probably prefer, the roadmap. And the unfortunate thing is, I can give you a roadmap. I can. I could tell you historically, so can you guys could probably tell each other. Here's what has worked in the past. The great thing about A is that things of the past may work, they may not. Things that you try now may or may not work. But what has to work is your output in your songwriting and making sure that if it's worship in particular, I'm just, my suggestion is to you is do not write for the church if your heart is not for the church. If your heart is for any other motivation, money, fame, especially money or fame, but whatever it is, if it's not to build the kingdom, if it's not to glorify God, and I'm not being self-righteous or condemning when I say that. I mean that from I know we're going to talk about the heart issues, but don't even do it. But if you're going to do it, write a lot. Write as often as you can. Play and lead worship as often as you can. Take risks. If there's a Bible study that doesn't have, if there's a kids group that doesn't have a worship leader, get in there and do it. Because the truth is one of these times, I'll be sitting in your congregation, or Malcolm will, or somebody from EMI, or somebody from Kingsway, and they're going to be like, that was an awesome song. Or Matt Redman will be sitting there. For whatever reason, he's friends with this guy, he's friends with that girl. And so you never know when the sort of, I think somebody threw out the term lottery, but you never know like when that moment's going to hit. The right person will be sitting at the right time and hear the song. More than anything, it's about, I think, God's sovereignty in making that happen. But there's a reality to God arranges appointments. He arranges things to happen. And so, sorry.
I'll say that I got two comments. One, as a person who's been like, I've been an insider and an outsider, so I'm kind of like moderately schizophrenic. But as someone who's been the insider, who someone approaches so I can, because I know someone or can do something for them, it's quite stressful to be the person that someone with all their heart believes that the Lord has given them these songs. And someone introduced them to me and they just want me to love them. And the moment someone comes to me with that desperation, I have minor heart palpitations because I don't know if it's any good. And if it isn't good, how am I going to respond? And it's just kind of stressful because I've probably had that happen to me in the thousands of times. So I know the signs. I know when someone feels, I know the first words. There's a few, the first phrases are usually, it's to do with God, and it's, I felt the Lord telling me, it's like, oh gosh, and I'm stressed. But if I go look, if someone tells me about you, and I go see your video on YouTube, and I don't have you looking at me, it's much more relaxing to me. So one thing I throw out there is, there's a lot of people making the best videos they can, and it actually helps someone like me. If you have the choice today to come give me your CD after this meeting, or go make a relatively decent video and make sure that Steve emails me your URL and I listen to it, probably the second one's going to help me. And I'm speaking metaphorically on behalf of people who work in industry things. So that's one comment. And my second comment was this. As a stats nerd who's interested in music business and counting, and you watch things, I just happen to know a lot of sort of random information. Like Matt Redman wrote Heart of Worship after a season of them not, you've all read the story of them not singing in their church. And so the opening line said, when the music fades, because they said they're too indulgent with music, let's sing a cappella for a little while. And the song was written in a heartfelt moment, and the song blazed a trail around the world. Not everybody knew the story. Not everybody knew the story that John Mark Macmillan wrote, Oh, How He Loves, because his friend died. Not everybody knows that Brenton Brown wrote Everlasting God when he was diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. Not everybody knows all the information, but statistically, more often than not, there's more of God's fingerprint in the landscape of what works in Christianity than man's fingerprint. Now, men have done a pretty good job of manipulating a bit, so there's a lot of humans putting their fingers in the pie. But the songs travel when they have integrity, and you don't have to say, you know, I had a bad experience and I wrote the song in a moment of great vulnerability. It translates. And no publisher, no connection, no famous person, nobody can accomplish what something that's truly believable accomplishes. So in some summary, I say to Brock, just do genuine things. I have a friend who's a very, 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 very famous DJ in the dance world. He grew up in a Christian home and is just a celebrity and a slightly naughty person. And and we talked last year. I was trying to wonder if he would do a sort of like chill out song with this one personality who I thought he would like, and I just ran the idea. And in that conversation, he said something. He's in a genre that's the fakest of all. Electronic music and all that goes with all of that, it's a fake genre. It's the most manipulated genre. It's just not what you would call organic. But he said something in that conversation that rang so true. He said, Mal, isn't it unusual that the only form of music that's about believing and about, it's built around belief, is most times the least believable music out there. And the whole world went silent for me for 15 minutes. I never heard the rest of the conversation because he wasn't being critical. He's just a guy who's wandered from his faith and had made a lot of money. But he actually said something true, that our music should be the most believable music. But oftentimes it isn't. And when it's believable, oh my goodness gracious me, someone who can help a friend, a YouTube video, a music company person, they don't have to work very hard. And, you know, that work can be really helpful. Doing things that have integrity are so much more meaningful than making an impact. I'm someone who's from show business. I've been involved in producing events. I've been at big events when there's a lot of people there. And I've often had the same feeling when the big stuff, when there's big rah-rah, you leave, there's just a bit of litter, and you leave this room or stadium and you think, I wonder if 10 years' time anybody's going to remember this or care. And now I'm old. I'm about to die. So many 10 years have come and gone. And mostly, nobody cares. I'm going to tell one story, moderately indulgent, to try to communicate the heart. I think we translate to heart things. Sometimes when we do something for God alone or for a single person or a simple context, it has integrity and it's powerful. I wrote a song. I'm the one song that they mentioned, it's the most embarrassing song ever. It's just cliche after cliche that I wrote spontaneously. It took as long to write as it takes to sing. But I had an experience many years ago, I was on the island of Penang in Malaysia. I'd never heard of Penang before I went to Penang. And I was with these churches ministering. It was exhausting. And the last day, we were just about to go to the airport, and my friend said, can we take you to meet the American missionaries at the Bible College? And I just thought, I'm exhausted. Please no. And they just didn't accommodate me. They just forced me to go. So I go, and I met this couple that were in their mid-70s. And my friend said, would you meet Malcolm Duplessis? And as they mentioned my name, this couple literally burst out crying, grabbed a hold of each other, and sobbed uncontrollably for minutes. It felt like now it was 15. It was probably 4 minutes at the time, but it was a very awkward mucus moment. And they hugged, and they hugged me, and I was like, I was smart. I don't want to be there. And I've got these two old people just like trembling and stuff. And it's like I'm just feeling stuff. And then they fell down, and they told the story. They said that they were falsely accused of some kind of impropriety as missionaries in Southeast Asia some years before. And they left Southeast Asia and went back to their church in Dallas in America with great shame and exhaustion and just humiliation and agony. And they went to a meeting and they sang this song that I wrote. And it touched them. And they saw my name on the overhead transparency. We didn't have projectors in those days. And they wrote it down and they prayed for me every day since that they could meet me. That was 85 and this was 91. And they said they could meet me. And when my friend, may you mention my name, this is an answer to prayer. And I'm the guy who didn't want to meet them. And I just think, you are funny old people. And then I wanted to spend the weekend with them because I just felt so affirmed. And they said, okay, now you must go because God has answered our prayer. We don't need to waste any of your time, young man. You've got important business to do. And I think, I don't want to leave your presence forever. You make me feel good. The reason for telling the story is, at that moment, I probably had 8 days in my life where I thought, if I die tonight and that was the only thing that ever happened in my life, cool. Because I remember going to bed that night thinking, if all that I did in my life was write a song that touched these people that I never knew, it was beautiful. And that song, it's not the most famous song in Christianity, but it earned me $200,000 in my day, and I'm poor. So it helped me. And there's something beautiful. There's a beautiful landscape in this kingdom for good things to happen, and we need to be thinking about that, and we need to maintain that constantly, because, and Steve and Vicky have obviously got much more grand of those kinds of stories, because my song's really lame, but I tell the story just to say, when we keep our hearts right, and we do God's things, beautiful things can happen.
So we're going to open up to Q&A in just a moment, but while we're here on heart issues, what would you say are potential pitfalls, things that you would advise people, you know, beware of this potential thing that could be a temptation for you, or, you know, a trap you can get into that maybe we can save you some heartache by being aware of, you know, certain things that could be going on in the heart that would be a part of this whole publishing and music and musicianship. Anything come to mind?
Yeah, I've been talking to myself.
Just a couple thoughts.
Yeah.
It's just too easy to chase money. I mean, that's really what a lot of this boils down to. It's too easy. The idea that you're going to get a significant advance or you're going to make a ton of royalties is too easy. And I think so much of it, the heart issue for me is that you have to make a decision now where you are as you sit right now that you're not going to chase it. And I know that's counterintuitive because in the business world, in the music world, you got to chase it. But we're a different breed and we're supposed to be a different breed to the world. And I would like to think that the things in my life that I know I can accomplish, that I don't chase any of them. I would like to believe that. In your songwriting careers, in the anointing, gifting, however you want to put it, that God has put on you, even that desire that it's not something that you will chase. And I say that because when you chase it, you start to build a world around that, a product. You start to build a world around, and your decisions become, everybody you meet is like, is this a potential I can give them my song? Is this a potential where I can, maybe I could play at the church? Everything that starts to go through a filter of how can I leverage? And leverage is not a bad thing, but I think you have to step back. In my own life, this is just a silly thing, but I've made a commitment in my own life that I'll deny myself something every day, whatever. So I go to Starbucks, I want a large, venti, whatever it's called. I have the money for it, I'll tell myself no. Not because I want to lose weight, not because my wife's going to smack me if I got a large. It's because I want to deny myself. And I do that as a practice every day of my life. Something, I'll just make a decision. I don't talk about it. I don't get anybody's help. I don't make a, hey, I'm fasting today. I'm talking about if a decision for your own heart. So if you look at songwriting and you commit to yourself, I will never write a song that chases. So right now, Malcolm's talked about how the publishing industry follows the church in some respects, what's happening in the church. We could probably identify maybe a few types of songs, like the epic, like, I'm not good with musical terms, but, you know, the building, whatever the musical terms are. You guys, you know,
I know what you mean.
There's a certain sound right now that's hot. So one of my clients is Jesus Culture, okay? You know that if you're familiar with Jesus Culture, that there are a lot of worship artists, songwriters, whatever, trying to emulate that. If you're trying to emulate it, you have to question, is that motivation the right motivation in writing a worship song? Because if you're trying to emulate other than God's heart, if you're trying to emulate a worship leader, a song you heard, whatever, it seems to me that it's a questionable approach to songwriting. So the trapping becomes you eventually go from an innocent person just trying to leverage one situation into every single interaction, every single decision becomes about leveraging that into, but I wrote this song for God, I wrote this song for church. It doesn't matter because people sin all the time in songwriting and in church and whatnot. So
that's good. Now I'm going to add anything?
Just the scripture that I think goes parallel with what Brock just shared. In the words of Jesus, to him who has, more will be given. But to him who doesn't have, even the little that he does have will be taken away. Nobody wants to be around a desperate, needy person. Any single time someone's just got a poverty mindset and just panicky the whole time, just wants to be loved, wants to be noticed, wants to be praised, it's exhausting. Especially when you're older than 3 years. I mean, there's a season when it's cute, and then it loses its cuteness. And that was Jesus. But to him who has a prosperous spirit, everybody wants to be around that soul. When Nike gave Tiger Woods $40 million and all those fancy shoes, and not me, they made a really good decision. Because I'm an overweight, middle-aged, not superior athlete. They were smart. And sometimes God's smart that way too. And sometimes in life, it's good to be smart that way. To just be the desperate soul who wants to be noticed is the most unattractive, unhelpful, miserable thing. But to be anchored in God and just say, no, I got a dignity. Everybody wants to be around that person, always. And when the song writes as that person, those songs look pretty.
And, you know, as you talk about that, I know we both feel this way. For us, trusting in God's goodness and his sovereignty in our area of our songwriting helps make us that way. Because we work hard, we're diligent, but we trust him for the results and let him exalt, you know, whatever song or situation he wants to. And when things don't go the way we want, we are content in him. Because if he's denied us something, it's for our good. It's for our good. It's better that it was denied than for us to have it. And so that's true in publishing and just songwriting in general. That's been important for us, yeah. Well, let's open it up to questions. Anybody? Here.
So, I was coming to this. I kind of asked the question, why do I care worship pastor, you write some songs in my church. The obvious answer seems like what you're saying is like, it doesn't really matter. But so my question to you really is, I'm a worship pastor, all church, I write some songs for my church, some go well, some don't. Why do I care about that? Or don't care about that? Not to demean what you guys do.
Okay.
I'd love to answer that. I think you care about it because it's a part of who you are. It's an asset. It's a piece of property that comes from your hands. And so part of it is stewarding something. God's given you a talent. You may look and say, who's going to care? I'm a worship leader in a church of, whatever, 500. And, you know, maybe no one really cares outside of this church. And that's fine. But if God has given you something, it's your job to shepherd that, steward that, and protect it, I think. And part of protecting is just understanding the landscape. You know, maybe you don't have to have the objective of getting published. Maybe it's just as simple as, how would you feel if I just happened to overhear your song and I started selling, you know, I recorded it and started selling it. And you're like, what do I do? Like, how does that person get away with that? If you don't understand the landscape at all, if you don't understand, and some of that's just strictly copyright protection, but some of it is just understanding how do people get the rights. You know, what are you going to do when your friend says, I love that song, our church wants to do it on an album, you don't even know what a mechanical license is. You know, so there's some simple technical things that just having a broad, a tiptoe into the topic understanding is going to make you, first of all, more knowledgeable, which is helpful for your own decisions. And then what are you going to do when your church says your song picks up and CCLI, it's a top 100 and you're making all this money and the church says, you know, I think we own that song because you're on staff. And so part of it too is just understanding, you know, I'm not the kind of lawyer that likes to file lawsuits and all that kind of stuff. That's a part of the law that I can't stand. But what are you going to do when you call me and say, Brock, my church is saying they own this song, and I know I own it. I wrote, you know, blah, blah, blah. You tell me all the facts. And yet you weren't in a position to get the knowledge early on to know. So for me, it's part of like, hey, if you're going to songwrite, why wouldn't you want to know your business? Unless you really don't care and you're going to let everybody use it. You don't worry about the money. And that's fine. If that's...
So is it basically just knowledge? Or is there... You use it copyright and stuff, but are there specific things I just should do because I care? Because I don't mean to say I don't care about myself. Basically at this point, just knowledge.
No, specific things, and I think this will benefit everybody. If you write a song, register it with the United States Copyright Office. Don't believe anybody that tells you, mail it to yourself. Judges have literally said that doesn't work. So it's false. Register with the United States Copyright Office if the situation for the U.S. works. If you're a foreign national or whatever, that's a different story. Number two, it makes sense if it's a worship song to register it with CCLI. Now there may be some hurdles to that. It may not qualify, but at least look into that. So everybody look at CCLI, understand what CCLI does. We've mentioned it here. It's a very practical thing you should do. Consider the performing rights organizations. In the United States, we have ASCAP, CSAC, and BMI. ASCAP is the largest by far. BMI is the middle. CSAC is by far the smallest. There's a lot of pros and cons. For me personally, if I have to give you a 10-second reason why to choose one, I would say because ASCAP, and do the research for yourself. I'm just saying as a professional in this field, ASCAP is by far the largest, meaning it has the largest number of songwriters, the largest catalog of songs, and is more likely to capture. So think about it this way. If you're a coffee shop and you have to get a performing rights license to play songs, you only have money for one. You're going to go for the biggest, ASCAP. So you register as a songwriter. A publisher will register. If you have a publisher, if you self-publish, you can register as a publisher, but otherwise your publisher registers. And then as a songwriter, you will list your songs. You will basically say, these are the songs that I've written. So if you're going to do anything at all, get it protected by copyright, copyrighted, not copywritten, it's copyrighted, CCLI, and one of the PROs, if you have no preference and have no reason to choose otherwise, choose ASCAP.
You know, a note on the copyright side of things. Of course, you could do one song at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Certain, what is it now, 50, 75 bucks?
I think 45.
You could also do a collection?
Yeah.
You do an album, have you recorded an album and do the whole thing?
If the same owner owns all the same content. So if you written 100 songs and it's just you, you can register. I believe there's no limit to the number. You can say this is my album and it's 100 songs long, one application. But let's say that you've co-written others. The most cost-effective way to do it would be to break it up into one application for the songs that you've written or you own 100%. Another application for the ones that are co-written. You know, you break it up by that.
So if they have the same percentage, they could be on the same copyright.
Same owners. I actually don't think the applications ask for percentage. It's the same owners.
Okay.
So, but if there's a third songwriter, then you have a third category of songs that you do.
And then, like with ASCAP, as a writer, I'm not even sure if they charge anymore. It used to be maybe $50 or something.
Publishers?
Publishers is in the hundreds, isn't it? Three or 400?
I think it's a little cheaper, but they do charge for publishing membership. And ASCAP, I don't think, charges for songwriting.
They used to take out, years ago, I think, an annual fee.
$35 for ASCAP publisher, $250 for BMI.
Okay.
Big difference.
Free
for
CSAC.
Yes.
Brock, our church has not had an intellectual property rights policy until recently. We've been in this big research thing. In your expertise, like from our viewpoint, we're finding that churches can go either way on whether they say it's owned by the church or owned by the songwriter or, in our case, a book writer. And then we've actually had one person in our congregation that's trying to argue that it's always the church that owns it.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Oh, it was We Declare Your Majesty, right?
Don't tell them.
It was I Want to Rock Right Now.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Is that the song, We Declare Your Majesty? Yeah.
We Declare Your Majesty.
The beginning. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's embarrassing. All
right. And it was under DJ Malcolm.
DJ Malcolm.
Sorry, I've totally lost my train of thought. Church. Yeah. So there is law, as we know, and the default United States copyright law says that when you create a copyright in the scope of your employment, the employer owns it. That's the law. The exceptions are if you somehow agreed otherwise, but that's the default law. So if there's not an agreement, that's the default law. Now your questions are going to be, did I author this book, did I write this song in the scope of my employment? If there's no record keeping, so I'm going to tell you about I'm not going to tell you about that. there's a public case, and if you're in Orange County, you'd probably be familiar, but I just don't want to offend anybody or whatever. So if you are an independent contractor or a volunteer, slightly different rules. Independent contractor, so maybe you're kind of treated as you're on staff, but you get a 1099. So unless you get it, if it's a W-2, you're going to be treated as an employee and what the court would look like. Because you have to fast forward. How does a court look at this? Court's going to say, what was your job title and what were your job duties? And if you're a worship pastor and you wrote a song, the court's naturally going to assume that's in the scope of employment. If you say, yeah, but I wrote them at home, the court's not automatically going to swallow that. So just so you know. If you're an author and you say, I wrote all my books at home. I have my own laptop. I wrote them on that. I can prove that. I hired a transcriber, whatever. If you have plenty of evidence, and that's the unfortunate thing, you have to think about the evidence. And I'm saying that because that is the real world. So if you can demonstrate that it was off the clock without any of the resources and that it wasn't part of your job duties, even if you're an employee, then arguably it's yours. But there's so many nuances and to that answer. So your church, and I could tell you, I advise the largest to the smallest churches in this country. So Willow Creek being one of the largest, if not the largest, or maybe they used to be, but whatever. Their whole intellectual property policies, I've gone through with them. I still go through with them. Everything in between I've gone through, and we've argued because some churches say, we want to attract creative types, and if we own everything, those people are never going to want to work for us. So their policy is, you own it. We don't care what it is. The issue for them is that now they have tax implications because that's private benefit to an individual. And so there's a whole other slew of issues that relate to tax-exempt status. So none of this is an easy question. I'm just trying to throw out thoughts that you have to consider, but I will tell you that there are some churches that have a policy that they own everything, And if you're in that environment, good luck to you, because that's what you have to deal with. If you feel like it's wrong, then you have to step up and say, I believe it's wrong, and here's why I believe it's wrong. And if you try and make a legal argument, they're most likely going to win. They're going to say, you're the pastor of adult studies, and I didn't mean that in a... I mean, like, for adults. Then and you're writing a book for that demographic, then your assumption is, I'm gonna own that. I'm gonna own the Bible study surrounding it, the curriculum, whatever you've developed. But what the church is gonna say is, that's a natural byproduct of your job. Even if your job duties, your job description doesn't say that you have to author materials, it's a natural byproduct. So I hope that helps.
And when that happens, is there a share? Do you receive a share? Or when you say own, they retain 100%?
They own it, and they don't have to pay you for it. I mean, your salary is your payment. That's what the law would default to.
Okay, question in the back.
You can, whatever you guys agree to, if the church and you and whoever it is agree, you can always make things retroactive, but the mistake would be not to consider the tax-exempt implications. Because IP-wise, copyright-wise, you can deal with that. We can say it's retroactive 20 years. The issue is going to be, did they now give you a private benefit, and it puts the church's tax-exempt status into question? And that's a big deal.
Yeah, so part of the issue there is, if you're using the church's resources and what would be your employment time mm-hmm. in creating whatever mm-hmm. the intellectual property is, it becomes... a problem.
That's the default, is that the church owns it, and you're out of luck.
So if you did it at home off regular work hours, it would be a little clearer.
Well, if you could prove that. And I mean, if I was you, number one, I would just have the conversation directly with my church. Mm-hmm. Hey, this is what I want to do. Can we clear this up now? That's your safest route. But if you can't, or you're afraid to, or whatever, create a very clear line of evidence. You know, whether that means having a witness see, or, I mean, it could be ridiculous, but protect yourself. I mean, why wouldn't you?
Question in the back here.
Well, yeah. I'm one of a few songwriters at our church that we've been doing our songs off and on for a few years. And my vision is to kind of rein it in and give pastoral oversight and kind of be a vital part of the ministry. Would it be a good idea for me to sit down with a lawyer like yourself before I actually do that?
Yeah, and if any of you knew me, you'd know I'm never selling anything. So you go to any lawyer that's qualified to give those answers. But absolutely, I mean, would you, if you had knee surgery and you wanted to know if you should walk on your knee yet, would you ask your wife, you know, or would you ask your doctor? And I mean, it's just...
Sure, I understand that. But what I guess my question is, we're already doing this.
Mm-hmm.
To make it actually part of the ministry within the church, there are legal ramifications.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I wasn't trying to be, I was trying to be funny, but not that funny. Thank you. I need those accolades. If the problem is if you hold off, because here's the worst case scenario. When a song doesn't go outside of your church, no one really is going to care ultimately. I mean, that's the reality. But if a song blows up, that's where, so I'm a Christian. I've been a Christian since I was 6 years old. Long line of Christians, family, whatever. But I've seen the ugliest side of the world, unfortunately, in representing the quote-unquote church. So no one's going to care right now where you are in this situation. You think, why are we going to waste money on a lawyer? That's fine. But you will care, and you will wish you did, when one of those songs does well. And there, even if there's $50,000 on the table, which in the grand scheme is not a lot of money, if you say, wait a second, no, you don't own that. I own that. And then that's where the whole thing unravels. And that's where the world looks and says, you guys can't even handle your own business, like the church, meaning. So.
I have a follow-up question for that. If we've got a song that we've been doing in a church that we wrote years ago, we now decide we're going to register a copyright. Do we register the copyright from when we wrote it or the day we registered?
The technical... correct response would be the copyright existed the date that you fixed it in a tangible medium of expression. So if that was 10 years ago, then the copyright date is 10 years ago.
Okay. Right here, and then we'll come here.
So still on the same subject, so what would need to be in place legally to actually, like if you work up, you talk with the church, the pastor, whoever, and they say, yeah, we want you to own your own stuff, but what needs to be in place
So a couple of things can be used. One would be just an IP policy. So the church has a policy that clearly states this is what our policy is. It's going to be difficult for the church to later argue that, oh, that wasn't our policy when they created it. That's one. An employment agreement, but understandably, you could be wary of an employment agreement, so could the church. And so it's a tool, but the employment agreement has other implications, namely, you're employed, and now do they owe you benefits, and all the other issues that come with that status. Short of that, just having an email. So I'm not big on 30-page contracts. I can navigate any size contract of any level, but if it's a napkin, write it on a napkin. I'm real big about just have something that a third party could objectively say, I think I know what these guys intended to do. Yeah, an email. I mean, you know, email, there's elements of proof, like did the person sending it actually send it, you know, all that. But yeah, if you want to type out on a Word document. Now, granted, everything I'm saying today, just the disclaimer, catch that woman that walked out because she's got to hear this too. None of this is legal advice, okay? This is me protecting myself. This is all just general information. The general response to you is if a court could look at that document and understood what the parties agreed to, and you could prove that the people signed it had authority to bind whoever they're intending to bind, that should be good enough.
So this is a really novice question. So it might be going down to rudimentary law, intellectual property and such. I'm, as you say, a lazy songwriter, in the sense that I get really into the song. And once it's done, I just want to share it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not really big on legality. But I go through things like CD Baby,
mm-hmm.
If you've probably heard of that. And, you know, well, actually, he's in the band, too. We put out an album, like a Christmas album, a little while ago. And I guess I really never thought about it, but are my songs protected because I pushed it through CD Baby? Like, does that mean it's published and it's copyrighted and all these things? Like, can someone still steal it? Do I still have a job to do to protect my intellectual property after pushing it?
Especially since he hired me before you know, first. No. So, in the United States, when you fix something in a tangible form, a written song, handwritten, typed, or a recording, it's protected by copyright law. But that protection only goes so far, which is why we seek federal registration, because that's where you get all the benefits, the true real benefits of copyright protection. Putting it on CD Baby would, by definition, constitute maybe a publication, but it adds no additional layer of protection. Now, it may add a layer of evidence, because if I come along and say, no, I wrote that song, and I wrote it, you know, June 15th, and you say, how could you, because I put it on CD Baby May 15th, that's an element of proof, but it doesn't actually protect you to put it on CD Baby. So my advice to you and anyone else that does that is, the second you write a song and you feel like it's close enough to the final product, and this is a very different issue than approaching a publisher or trying to get your song out there. I'm just talking from a purely legal protective standpoint. Record it. Acoustic is fine. It doesn't have to be produced or anything. Record it and submit it to the Copyright Office, because anything less than that is not as effective. And you have, with a copyright registration, you have a presumption of ownership and a presumption of a lot of things, but, you know, the time that you submitted it, all that kind of stuff. Without a registration, there are no presumptions, so you have to prove all that stuff. So,
so just because I'm curious, like, they ask me to do stuff like, oh, we need to give you a UFC or whatever, or UPC.
UFC.
UFC, no. Yeah, they did not actually ask me to fight.
When TuneCore or CD Baby asked you?
Yeah. So, like, what does that actually do for the product itself?
So, those types of things are identifying marks, kind of like the number of the beast. So, I'm just kidding. No, they're identifying marks to designate a product. So, you'll hear what's the digital
ISRC.
So you'll hear these different terms thrown around. All those ultimately are what they function as, is ways to identify either a song, a sound recording, or an album, or something like that. So if they ask you for that, I think CD Baby in particular will provide those. You don't have to.
Yeah.
So that's what it is identifying mark. So they know
So it wouldn't be a copyright protection at all. It's individual product code. It's just a business identification. Yeah. Okay. One more? Ms. Sy? A yes or no? Okay. We can do a couple of those.
Shut that guy up.
Everything you're saying, can you apply to rearrangements of a public domain song?
Generally speaking, yeah. So public domain means that it's in the public domain and that copyright protection no longer exists. So we take a song from the 1500s, it's now in the public domain. But you take it and you say, okay, there's four verses and there's a melody. So I'm going to keep the first verse, rewrite the second verse, change the melody, a couple lines, a couple words or whatever, and this is my new song. Maybe you add a, whatever the technical term is, some bridge or something like that. So when you seek protection, imagine visually that this is the public domain and this is you, these three fingers are your additions to it or changes to it like this. They don't merge into a unitary whole. If you wrote a song today with me, they merge into a unitary whole. But when you take a public domain, it's always going to be the separate piece of property and yours is sort of layered on it, in it, whatever. So if there's a dispute, the court would immediately separate and say, this is all that you can protect. So if I take or anyone else takes that exact same public domain song and maybe doesn't keep the first verse, changes the second verse, maybe even some of it looks or sounds like yours, that's a totally different issue and it'd require a lot more discussion. But the point is you can only protect what you've added, and yes, you can protect it. You would, on the copyright application, effectively you're saying pre-existing work is the public domain song. I've added blah, blah, blah.
Was there one more here? Okay, last one. Here we go.
How, if you're writing songs in a church somewhat with your team, how particular, if you're trying to copyright, you need to be, you know, factoring in other writers or contributors? If somebody, if you were bouncing lyrics off of them and they gave you one idea, you know, or one guy came up with one guitar lick that maybe is more like a part of the arrangement than the, you know, what, how do you think?
Like who owns what percentages? This question I get all the time. Even from very experienced songwriters and bands, to me, that really comes down to what you think is fair. I mean, I'd like to say that there's a legal answer. The practical answer is if you think that your melody is worth, you know, 90% of the song, then so be it. It's a matter of working that out with the people that are songwriting. But again, this is, I'm not pushing anything. I wrote an article that would help kind of give examples, and I don't rather than email people individually, which I can do, I don't know if there's a central place to put it or give it. But if you want to give me your email address or anybody does, I'd probably be better off posting it online. Well, you know, actually, I think it might be on my blog.
Do you have it on your blog?
What's your blog?
I don't know if it is. It's Brock Scheinen. It's mostly cooking stuff. I'm a foodie.
of course.
So I don't know if it's on there. I'll give you my email address. So you can give me yours. I'll email it to you. But if I start to get a lot of people, maybe we just do one place for it. But anyways, the short answer is you have to work that stuff out, and you need to work it out beforehand. Because I have clients that are like, they'll come to me and say, this worship leader is the big shot, and they think they wrote 95% of the song when all they did was write, you know, like one line and one verse. That's for you guys to fight out. I hate to say it, but you got to be grown-ups and fight about it. Not literally, but, you know, work it out.
Good.
It's good to determine the policy if you can before to save stress.
Yes.
So, you know, say, okay, we agree that if two of us come into the room, irrespective of who contributes the most, it's a 50-50 split.
Yeah.
We agree that if you come with the idea and I manipulate the idea, 75-25 in my favor, you can just set some guidelines. Mm-hmm. Because as Brock said, people that have spent their lives songwriting don't like to discuss that up front. Mm-hmm. And it never, ever makes it easy. There's always drama.
Okay, one thing. After this is over, and I don't know what everybody has next, but I just feel like if there's anybody that would like me to pray for them, and maybe Malcolm or you guys would, just in terms of your songwriting and stuff like that, I'd be more than happy to. I just feel like God kind of urging me to throw that out there. And if no one needs it, wants it, that's fine. But
okay, and you'll be right here.
I'll stay right here.
Okay, very good. Well, our time's up, but we're available to answer questions if you'd like.